Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Troy Noons is an Absolute Podcast. I'm your host, as always, John Casillo, and with me today is Dan Lyons.
Hello, everyone. Happy Florida State Week.
Happy Florida State Week.
2-0 for the first time in a couple of years week, and other things.
Yeah, we usually just commemorate this week by just kind of, like, messing around and having fun with the Noles and knowing we're going to lose. But then, like, last year we almost sent it to overtime, and this year we might win.
The Noles are messing around and look pretty terrible, and ESPN's Football Power Index thinks that we're the favorite, and we look a lot better than them, weirdly, against, like, oh, I won't say similar competition. They played Virginia Tech, who looks pretty good, but we blew out our FCS team, and they played, like, a better FCS team, but almost got, like, really almost got beat. So, yeah, it's, and we're at home. Yeah, there's a, I'm trying to stay muted in my expectations, but I don't think it's unrealistic to say this should be a very competitive game.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a couple different struggles here for Florida State, obviously, and this is something we're going to get into more in the second half, but when you have a defense that's struggling to stop the pass, when you have an offensive line that's struggling to stop pressure, those two things would kind of lean right into the things that Syracuse has actually shown themselves to be decent at this year. Obviously, our defense isn't that great. And that leads to Florida State probably being able to get its offense going. Should be a shootout of some sort. But again, things we'll talk about in the second half of this episode. Right now, Dan, talking a little bit about our previous game. Obviously, you know, you don't want to bring too many, like, takeaways necessarily from, you know, beating up on a team like Wagner. But at the same time, a couple things that I noticed off the top. Offensive line struggled once again, this time against a much worse team than Western Michigan. Receivers looked a lot better. Devin Butler did not, even if the numbers seemed to indicate otherwise. Eric Dungy, for a second, I thought, looked like he was still feeling the after effects of whatever shoulder injury he had. And I think over the course of the game, he worked those out. Andre Sisco's awesome. He also can let up big plays because he's going for a big play, but I'll accept that trade-off if he's going to keep picking the ball off. And then number five, and don't feel like you have to respond to all of these, Jarvion Howard's got to be a really great running back for us.
Yeah, I'm trying to digest everything you just said. Working from the back, I guess, because that was the most recent thing. Jarvion Howard did look really, really good. Unfortunately, I mean, it was like a little bit past the time where I kind of zoned out in the game a little bit because I was focusing on other games. But when I, you know, did look it up, he looked like the player that we kind of discussed preseason. I think I said a couple weeks ago that I thought he might get involved in the run game since, you know, there are lingering questions about Strickland and Neal, who have both had a very good moments through these first two games. But I do think Howard has shown enough to where, you know, against an overwhelming opponent, but still, like, I think he brings a different dimension to those two guys, and I wouldn't mind seeing him in some bigger spots. I think Neal's been very good for two games. It was nice to see Dungy play a little bit more of, like, a normal quarterback game. Obviously, his rushing is a thing, but I like to see him, you know, dropping back there and throwing five touchdowns. That was nice. And mostly avoiding, you know, big hits and craziness that we saw in the Western Michigan game. I was, you know, there were some moments of concern with the defense. Obviously, the touchdown drive, they went right down the field on us, and that was early enough in the game where it kind of spooked everyone. We did a really nice job against their running attack, though, which was positive considering we had talked about Ryan Foles, who I think had 280 yards in the previous game. He had 47 on 21 carries in this game, and overall they had 41 yards on 41 carries. So we really stifled that, as you should against an FCS opponent. But, you know, that's holding someone to 1 yard carry is pretty good. But they did take advantage on the against our secondary when they did complete passes, which, you know, they threw about 50%, but they were getting about 14 yards over 14 yards a catch, which is not great. They had three players go for catches over 20 yards. Obviously, the one big one to Darren Wilson. So that remains a concern and one that I think will carry itself into the Florida State matchup where they, you know, have been super impressive, but they do have a veteran quarterback in DeAndre Francois and some very fast receivers as we've gotten to know over the last couple of years. So definitely some good takeaways from the Wagner game, but 62-10 against an FCS opponent should be what we expect, and I'm obviously happy with it, but it wasn't like so much of a slaughter that there are like no concerns about our team after this game either.
That's kind of what I tried to get in, you know, regarding that article I posted on Sunday. Just, I saw a lot of, and like, believe me, I'm very optimistic about what the season looks like. It looks like we've addressed some issues while others maybe have taken a step back. I think Dungy is making, some efforts to run smarter, stay healthier. Who knows? But I do think a lot of Syracuse fans are kind of, you know, they're drawn to the allure of being back and feeling like this program's back on its feet. I think that you know, Syracuse being quote unquote back has a lot of different connotations. I think that means different things to different people. Personally, I think consistently winning 6 games is back. Some people think that winning 9 or 10 is back, and unfortunately for the latter group, that's not a very realistic outcome for this program. But if you just want to look at us as a potential, you know, bowl contender, I mean, I would say we definitely are. But I would say, like, those who are putting the blinders on, saying 4-0, here we come, like, let's take it one game at a time. We could very well start 4-0. However, there are some real concerns. They're ones I highlighted in the post. I highlighted them a little bit in those recaps that I just named earlier. Like, there are issues, but because this team is so young, I think is why I'm taking a little bit of encouragement that a lot of these things can fix themselves, even if not all of them.
Yeah, there is definitely improvement that can be made during the season, especially, I hope, for the offensive line. They've been, I wouldn't say bad, I'd say shaky through 2 games. Especially, we discussed the whole, like, when DeVito came in situation against Western Michigan.
It happened again.
And even, like, throughout the game, like, Wagner got more pressure than they should. Not quite the Central Connecticut debacle of last season, but by debacle, I mean we won, like, the same margin as we won this game. But still disconcerting enough. And then we saw that offensive line step up a couple weeks later and handle the best defensive front in the country, and it's Clemson. So hopefully we see something more like that in the future. And we're going to need it because Florida State has some guys on that side of the ball on the defensive front, although they haven't played great yet. At least I saw all the Virginia Tech game. They really weren't a huge factor. I saw parts of the Samford game. They didn't seem to be a huge factor. But you know, they have a lot of talent on the front line, and as does, like, the ACC as a whole. Obviously, there's no more Bradley Chubb, but Clemson has, you know, the very well documented 4 all ACC type players up there, and BC has some guys, and NC State's all talent up there. So it's going to be an issue for us going forward, and hopefully the offensive line continues to meld and develop and improve throughout the season. Otherwise, this could get a little sticky.
Yeah, I mean, Florida State's not necessarily going to be able to generate a ton of pressure on us. We also should be able to get rid of the ball pretty quickly. I just want to see the run game be able to develop. So, you know, Florida State should be able to generate some pressure. Connecticut maybe not as much. But, yeah, then we get Clemson. We get a team like Pitt that can generate pressure. NC State, like, those games are coming up quickly on the schedule. And if we're not able to sort out this offensive line quickly, I'm very concerned for the type of pressure that Dungy's going to be under again. And obviously, you know, the second you start mentioning too much pressure for Dungy, that starts equating to hits. And that starts equating to how every season so far for him has ended at Syracuse. So, like, I'm not going to paint this picture that it can't be fixed. I think what's more worrisome for me than anything is how it's the problems that are happening on the interior of the line where these guys are all back. You know, if the right tackle position with, you know, Coda Martin, if for some reason he just, like, wasn't in rhythm with all these guys yet, then sure, I could be a lot calmer about that. But because I'm seeing all these lapses in the interior part of the line and guys who are veterans and you know, including, like, Aaron Roberts, who's one of our best, Evan Adams, again, like, that part of the line's getting blown up. And that's really tough to see at any point, but it's especially tough for a team that needs to be able to run the ball inside consistently in order to make this offense go.
Yeah, it was the interior, especially in the first half when I was paying closer attention. Like, the interior of the line was really the problem point, as you said. And Evan Adams was out for the first half, I believe, right?
Yeah.
That was a suspension. So he came back in the second half, and things seemed to go a little better as we, you know, for the couple drives we had Dungy in. But overall, like, you do not want to be giving up inside pressure, especially with Dungy at quarterback. He's very good at finding those seams in the, like, inside the pocket and stepping up into them and then making a lot of his best run plays through those seams. You don't want to have him floating outside because then you run the risk of having really bad throws off your back leg, or you have sacks that are like 9-10 yard losses. And he's not going to be able to outrun, you know, the Florida State defensive ends or the Clemson defensive ends on the edge as easily as he was able to outrun the guys from Wagner and Western Michigan. So I'd much prefer, if there's going to be pressure, like, I'd rather have my senior quarterback dealing with the pressure coming off the edge than, you know, guys blowing up the interior, because that's a lot more difficult to deal with because it's right in your face.
No, completely. I think that, you know, again, it's not something that's unfixable, but it's something that's definitely a concern. I'm looking forward to seeing how that gets addressed going forward. The other thing, and I know we already mentioned a little bit, Devin Butler, I don't know how long he is for the starting lineup. Dino seemed to have some positive things to say about him. I doubt he would have said anything negative about him anyway during today's presser, but he highlighted his blocking. He did have a few grabs, but I did feel like while he made some progress from week one, there were still drops. He really did get beat badly on that that interception in the end zone. Just guy had complete positioning on him. I felt like he had another couple balls where I was just very confused as to what happened. He was really getting like kind of out-muscled by much smaller defenders. I mean, Butler's what, 6'3", 6'4"? Like, he's a guy who should be able to out-position people. And like, we have receivers that can do that already. But I think for Butler, the biggest problem too was the fact that Taj Harris came in and to replace him for a bit in the second quarter, and within seconds he'd caught a 20 plus yard touchdown pass. So depth chart says that Butler's starting again. I think I believe it for now. I think that the leash is getting shorter and shorter for him though. While Sean Riley, a guy who also kind of struggled in game one, also was dropping balls, but did seem to find a better way to make bigger plays when he was able to wrangle the football.
Yeah, the Butler thing, he was better than he was in week one, but it would have been kind of hard to be worse. The blocking is important, but it's not like we're running a ton of outside like counters and sweeps and stuff with his offense. Like, most of the stuff's been in the tackle box.
We already have guys to block, too. I mean, Pierce has been pulled in a ton. Elmore and Kleinberg have all been pulled in a ton to block on the edge.
Right, so that's not to discount like the importance of outside blocking. Right. Receivers who block well tend to do really well at the next level, especially. Like, it's a thing that NFL teams look for, and it's definitely a big part of a game. But it's not like going to get you, you know, something to leave you in as a starter when you're just not a factor in terms of the actual pass catching component of playing receiver. And then when you said, like you said, Taj Harris obviously only had the one catch, but it was probably the most impressive offensive play of the game. At least by a receiver. Costas continued to look really good. I think he had one big one called off, right?
Yeah.
He had an offensive pass interference.
Yeah. An offensive pass interference. It was like a little ticky tack, but
yeah, it wasn't like the most egregious call, but it was like that was in the end zone, I think, right?
Yeah, I'd be much more angry in like an ACC game.
Right. So I mean, he looked good again. Not the same kind of numbers, but like enough of a performance where you're like, okay, that wasn't a total fluke. Like, he was still imposing that mismatch that we saw in the first week, and we were, I think, trying to spread the ball around more. And then Riley and Nikeem Johnson both looked really good. It was really nice to see. We've talked about Sean Riley at length over the last couple of years, where his coming in and out of the offense in weird bursts. But
the tip drill catch was fun.
The tip drill catch was amazing. Just really, really, I mean, it was not far off the ground when he caught it. That was just really good. He just paid really good attention and you know, was very fast twitch there, and not a play a lot of guys would have made. And it's not like you would have blamed him for not making it, but he was right there on it and very aware of the situation. And then Johnson looked really good too. We talked about him. He led the team with 65 yards, and he had a score of his own.
He's going to be so good. Like, I can't wait for him to like round into being like a feature guy in this offense.
Yeah. So there are guys here, and then Pierce only had the one catch for 3 yards, and it was a really nice touchdown on that like somewhat of a trick play that we had going, which was nice. I expect Hill to continue to expand. You know, we saw last year, like, right around midseason when he started to peak, but we haven't seen, like, everything he can do yet. So, yeah, I'm not super – I feel better about the wide receiving core as a whole this week, but Butler remains a bit of an enigma, and it would be nice if he woke up. I know Dino knows him better than we do, so I'm sure like the kind words today were, you know, how he feels like he needs to handle the situation with that one player, where other players might be more amenable to more critical words from his coach. But we'll see. If Butler can't be a guy, we have at least like three or four here who seem to have flashes of being able to be one of the main guys. Plus, you throw in Moneal and Strickland in the passing game, plus Pierce at tight end. Like, I'm not super worried about it. We just need some of these guys to work, not just like one.
Yeah, I mean, like you and I have been saying, as much as it's an experience, it seems, you know, a little weird, and you know, seeing like the ball spread around this much, like, is a good thing though. Like, I want as many of these guys as possible to get experience. Maybe that doesn't happen against Florida State necessarily, but you know, we started going down that road against Wagner. We'll probably go down that road against UConn too. Just getting as many of these guys involved, like getting Taj Harris that touchdown on his first catch, like that's a great confidence builder. Like, we still haven't really seen Cameron Jordan or RTB or some of the other guys. Like, Anthony Quealy hasn't really been seen either. Like, there's a ton of guys here. Ed Hendricks. Like, there are a bunch of guys left that we can still get on the field. I think it's just whether or not Dino's comfortable with them. You know, he's not one to make a player wait just by way of, you know, what year they are. I think we're going to see you know, more and more different combos out there, just to see what these guys can do. And again, like Butler or anybody, like, not just to pick on him, like anybody doesn't necessarily show up, I think Dino's going to have a pretty short leash for them for the rest of this year. So, and rightfully so, considering like how much this team really needs the passing game to succeed with the run game kind of, you know, hot and cold and still largely dependent on Dungy.
Yeah, this week will be a good test, because Florida State obviously has been pretty well known for its defensive backs over the last couple of years, and they have a lot of talent in that group. So, granted, that is a group that we'll talk about more after the half, but a group that gave up a lot of yards this past weekend. So the receivers will have their chance to prove themselves this weekend.
Agreed. Like we said, there's not like a ton to talk about with the Wagner game. A couple notes. Eric Dungy tied the school record for touchdown passes in one game. 5. Ryan Nassib did it against Maine back in 2010. And then Zach Mahoney, of all people, did it against Pitt back in 2016. Y'all remember the game. Is the highest scoring regulation contest in FBS history.
Yeah, I mean, if we had left Dungy in, like, odds are he would have broken it. And he'll have a couple more shots if we wanted to go for 6 at UConn.
Maybe this weekend.
Vulnerable. Yeah, well, Florida State looks quite vulnerable. UConn looks pretty atrocious. And then Pitt just gave up so many points to Penn State. And Penn State's good, but the Penn State passing attack hasn't even looked like all that crisp yet. And Pitt was just so overmatched. So I'm not saying that Pitt's terrible. They might have just gotten in their own heads about that rivalry after a lot of trash talk from both sides. But, man, they did not look like a team anywhere ready to compete with a team like Penn State, and definitely not even like the team they were 2 years ago when they beat Clemson. So we'll see. I'm not going to count out the Panthers as a threat yet, but
they're looking more like the team you and I said they were.
Yes, we did not. It does not appear at this point that we 2016 USC'd ourselves with Pitt. I don't think Pitt's going to the Rose Bowl.
2018 USC might 2016 USC themselves.
Yeah, well, 2018 USC, I don't think anyone had, like, super high expectations for. But, yeah, they don't look great either. Not world beaters.
No, not at all. You brought up UConn. We'll talk to them next week. However, one of the most miserable box scores I've ever seen.
I haven't even looked at the full one, but I've seen enough people talking about it. I'm going to do it right now. I know what the score, like, roughly what the score was.
814 yards allowed.
Yes. I mean, Boise State looks really, really good. Like, better
horrifyingly. I think they're going to wipe the floor with Oklahoma State this weekend.
They very well may. Oklahoma State looks fine.
Yeah, but it won't matter.
Boise State, what I really enjoy about this box score is the consist. Like, they wound it down as the game went on, but they still scored a touchdown every quarter, and they went from 24, 17, 14, and 7. Like, it was like they were gently bringing the engine to a stop, but not until, like, they were totally ready. Brett Rippon is really, really good. Just a really great college career. 400 yards on the ground is absurd, and 418 yards in the air is also absurd. When was the last time? Did someone look up the numbers of, like, when the last time we had a 400-400 game from a team?
I'm sure Texas Tech probably did it at some point.
Well, I don't know. Those Leach teams were not all that balanced.
No, not even like the Leach teams, like the more recent ones.
Oh, you think?
Oh, like, maybe. Well, because there was that game, what was it, like a couple years ago? The Kingsbury game, what's his face? Mahomes, where they had like 900 yards of total offense or something.
Oh, right. That was a shootout. Like, they were.
Yeah, I forgot who that. Maybe it was against Baylor. Who knows? That was a potential, I would assume, in the 400 range. Like, maybe some of the peak Baylor teams.
That's possible. Baylor makes more sense because they were always a little more balanced. Yeah. I'm going to go on Twitter and while we're discussing and see if I can find it. I'm sure someone someone had, it was like such a, it's such an anomaly that I assume someone looked it up after Boise.
Yeah.
Like obviously people were taking note of it, but yeah, just crazy. And UConn just does not look very good.
Well, I appreciated the fact that David Pindell, after like a strong dual threat performance in game one against UCF, did not look good at all in game two. I think Boise's defense is probably better than UCF's. It's also really tough to judge UConn at this point because, like, who knows how truly bad they are when they face two top 25 teams to start the season.
That's true. That's about as hard a schedule. I mean, that's probably the hardest back-to-back weeks of non-P5 teams you could get. I mean, hosting UCF, I guess, and they looked okay for a minute. But then going to – they were in Boise, right? And they just got just got waxed. So, like, honestly, like, the score doesn't even – like 62-7 seems more normal than what the actual numbers look like. Like Boise probably should have scored more.
Yeah, I'd have to agree there. I know a couple random notes just to go with everything else. Like, you know, while we're closing out the first half, I don't know how much you paid attention to the ACC scoreboard. It seems like the conference isn't really doing that well this year. Some of those opponents are on our schedule. Some of them are not. I felt like Louisville really struggled against Indiana State. For much of that game, I mean, they pulled away, but didn't really look that impressive doing so. NC State kind of just sleptwalked through another game. Notre Dame, ACC adjacent, looked pedestrian at best against Ball State. I'm not going to extrapolate this out to Syracuse's schedule. I'm just going to point out how strange all of this is.
Yeah, I think you can, like, North Carolina is probably just bad. Again, which is not good for Larry Fedora of, you know, football military industrial complex fame. they lost to ECU. Was probably looking like the worst team in FBS outside of UTEP and Kansas. Obviously, Kansas got a big win this weekend, so congrats to them. UTEP is horrid, but they have a new coach, and we'll see how well that lasts. ECU was right in that conversation. Stoddy Montgomery was a strong contender to be the first coach fired this year, and they beat UNC by multiple touchdowns, I think.
22 points?
Yeah.
And now Larry Fedora is the number one coach to get fired this year.
Like, you can't embarrass your school in a layup press conference where you know every question that's going to be asked, and then also lose to one of the worst teams in FBS in your state by 22 points.
I should have asked my parents. I'll ask them if there are any R state signs popping up around the freeways of North Carolina as we speak.
Also, to a former Duke assistant, which they probably don't even know, but I'm sure there are a couple people that were extra stunned by that. Although I'm not sure how much North Carolina football fans are paying attention to where Duke assistants end up. But yes, that was overall the ACC was probably due for a slight step back. And, you know, it might be a year where the teams are just not as good across the board because they've been very, very good for a couple of years now. And hopefully Syracuse can take advantage.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I think Duke might be screwed because Daniel Jones' injury. I think that Virginia Tech, we'll really see how good they are because if Florida State's as bad as we think, then that win by Virginia Tech in game one isn't necessarily what we believed it was at the time. You know, obviously Florida State's probably a six-win team or so. You know, Louisville really don't know because they look bad against Alabama. They didn't really look great against Indiana State. NC State, again, sleepwalking. Like, BC, to be honest, is probably one of the three or four best teams in the conference.
BC is definitely, like, living up to, or at least so far, they haven't played anyone really, but
they've done what they were supposed to do.
They looked like every bit as good as people were hyping them up to be, so that's a little scary, but if NC State and Louisville and all these other schools are going to look, you know, as poor or as mediocre as they have, like, it works itself out. And Syracuse has looked, you know, better than people probably thought outside of our bubble where we, you know, thought we were bowl contenders here. So, yeah, it's one of the things. I want the ACC to look good, but my first priority is Syracuse making a bowl and looking good. So I'm way more concerned about that, and I'm not going to worry too much about, you know, the ACC having one down year because I think the ACC has done enough to build back up its, like, reputation that, like, one down year isn't going to make people, like, acting like they were in 2013 or whatever.
Yeah, I think we're going to be fine there. I know I was talking to some people in the comments, and, like, if Clemson goes undefeated and makes the playoff that and we go 6-6, like, that's a plus for us on both ends because, I mean, whatever on Clemson, but it could be anybody. I don't care. It could be Virginia Tech. as long as somebody gets the playoff, we get paid. And if we make a bowl game in the process because the conference took a half step back this year, all for it.
Absolutely.
I think that brings us to halftime. We could jump in a little early so we could talk more Florida State. Have quite a bit to discuss about the team, what they've done. I know Bill Connolly had that great article today about what the hell is wrong with Florida State and pointed out a couple big things. I might take them apart for an article tomorrow or Wednesday. Worst case, we'll just talk about them here. So.
Oh, I found the answer to the team that had... This is really unfortunate for us.
Oh, God. Is it Florida State?
No. There are three teams. The Boise State game was, according to College Football Reference...
Ooh, one of them was Louisville, wasn't it?
Yep.
The other one was
Louisville
USF, wasn't
it? Louisville in 2016 had 431 passing and 414 rushing.
Week two
a couple years ago. So that was one. And the other one, you're never going to guess. I'm just going to tell you. 2012 Louisiana Tech against Idaho had 431 passing and 408 rushing.
That's fun. That was the last year of the WAC, wasn't it?
That was the WAC. That was Sonny Dykes, and that was a 9-3 Louisiana Tech team, led by Kenneth Dixon on the ground, and who was the quarterback?
I remember they didn't go to a bowl because they thought they were deserving of a better bowl than they got invited to.
Yeah, Colby Cameron. That was a really good team. They had, you know, a 4,000-yard passer and an almost 1,200-yard rusher and then another 740-yard rusher.
Last year, the WAC was dope. They had, like, three top 25 teams.
Yep, and then they folded because conference realignment, which we were a part of, but not directly involved in the WAC folding.
We weren't directly involved in anything, Dan. Don't let anybody put that on us. It wasn't our fault.
Oh, that was the year San Jose State went 11-2.
Yeah.
And have been utter trash since then.
I wonder why.
Mike McIntyre did a nice job this weekend. That was I wouldn't say he was in the hot seat because Colorado was so bad, and what he did a couple years ago was impressive.
A lot of questions.
But like, it looked like it might have been a fluke, and he had a really nice win against Nebraska on the road this week.
Scott Frost, just welcome home.
Yeah, I mean, I think people were hyping. Like, I think Scott Frost is really good, and he'll do really well there. I think people were overestimating how well he was going to do, like, from the drop.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
Like, and Colorado might be pretty decent, so we'll see.
Yeah, we will see. Because I was not high on Colorado, as we recall from... Maybe it wasn't this Pac-12 episode that got to the airwaves, but there was a Pac-12 episode where I was not high on Colorado.
Yes, it's the Pac-12 episode you can hear in, like, another dimension.
And,
another universe where the only change is that Earth our original 44. Pac-12 episode got released.
That would be the worst episode of Fringe. Anyway, Dan, what have you been drinking for the past week? Well, not even week, like four or five days.
I still have a cold, but I was out a lot this weekend for a friend's birthday, which was dumb, but we did it. So I had a couple things. I had Gang of Blades by Burial, a really good North Carolina brewery. Which is a really solid pale ale. I had a bunch of sours and Joes this weekend. Just like the places we went happened to have a lot of those in the menu that I want to try. I had some of the best ones. The Kimmy the Yink and the Holy Goza by Anderson Valley over your way. They make a lot of really good Joes and sours, and definitely among them. I had Distill Brewing from Normal, Illinois. Their Wild Sour series, their Syncopathic. I had a Joza from Five Boroughs, which I've had before, which is quite good. And then in the non-Joza and Sour department, I had a Green City IPA from Other Half, which is always solid. I had an 18-watt, which is a Session IPA from Single Cut, which is always good. And then another, you know, putting a toe in the pumpkin beer waters here again, the Imperial Pumpkin Ale by Weyerbacher, which is I've had before and kind of forgot how good it was. Really, really solid. A little darker, a little more fully flavored than some of like the more pale pumpkins, but very good nonetheless.
Not a bad list. Not a ton for me. Kind of took it easy this weekend. Had Luponic Distortion from Firestone. I've mentioned them a couple times. Pete's Port, they had a new IPA, The Fish, that was on draft near me. And then had from Indie Brewing Company around LA, Anti-Gravity, their Brute IPA. I don't know if you guys have those out by you yet, but kind of Brute IPAs are turning into a trend out here where they're like champagne-style IPAs. Much drier finish.
I haven't seen those, but I'm definitely interested in something that kind of shakes it up a bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think they started around San Francisco. I feel like they started doing them a little bit more up there. I've seen a bunch down here.
I'm sure we'll get it in like next spring.
Yeah, and then everyone will be lining up outside for that, and the Haze Bros will finally go away. Who knows? But yeah, for some reason, felt like hell on Sunday. I'm not sure why. Saturday, I felt like hell. So that was the end of my drinking was Friday night.
Yeah, solid though.
Yeah.
I will probably be going a little easy. Well, no, actually, no, that's completely wrong. My birthday this weekend. I will not be going easier this weekend.
Yeah.
Yes, I have I've had this cold and it's like ruined my brain, so I can focus on like some things, but then I forgot what key to put in what lock in my door, and also like forgot my birthday is Wednesday, and other fun things. So maybe that's old. Maybe that's just me getting old, and maybe it's just I can't get over this damn illness.
Hey, I'm hoping you're over it, and I'm hoping Wednesday is the day that you can put it to rest for good.
Yes, that would be appropriate. That'd be a solid week. Hopefully Wednesday I'm fine. I will have one of the White Oak Hyalis in my fridge, and then hopefully this weekend will be fun. And hopefully Syracuse wins. That'd be a good 28th birthday present from the old alma mater.
Syracuse usually deals me a random non-conference loss, or actually in-conference loss, on my birthday in early January every year. It's usually Louisville or Boston College or something else stupid, but alas, they give me so much other joy at other times of the year. Maybe this Saturday. So, talking a little bit of Florida State here, Dan. Bill identifies four things that are definitely bad about Florida State right now. Third down struggles for them. Red zone offense is terrible. They are not good at forcing third downs, which sounds great for us. And slow starts. These all sound great for Syracuse. We've started fast this year after, I think, a couple of years of starting slower than we would have liked. We have looked better in the red zone. Our red zone defense was actually pretty good last year. This year, they haven't really been tested that much, because that's the other problem, though, is that we're not ones to necessarily make you go to the red zone. We just let you score from 70 yards out. Our third down defense was actually pretty good last year. We, at one point, were the number one third down defense in the country. We faded.
I was going to say, it was amazing last year, and then it kind of fell off.
Finished like 20th.
Yeah, it regressed to the mean hard when we stopped scoring points, but it was still good.
Yeah, it was still fine. I would say that these four things sound good, but again, like, caveats abound for Syracuse given the opponents in weeks
and,
1 and 2.
And sample size.
Right. Always the problem in college football in general. The sample size is rarely enough.
Yeah, right now I'm just pulling up CFB stats. Syracuse on offense is 56th. In third down conversions, which is not bad. It's fine.
I feel like we face fewer of them. I mean, that could be completely wrong. I didn't get to rewatch this week's yet. I'm doing that tonight.
Let me look.
We had 17 in the first week. That
I just looked at the Wagner. We definitely had fewer. We were 6 of 13, so a couple fewer. And then we were 2 of 3 on fourth.
I feel like we're getting better gains on first down, though, which is helping. Obviously, like, we don't, like, when we face third downs, I feel like we're facing long ones, but we're doing a better job of picking up quality yardage on first, which is really what keeps this offense going at a positive clip.
And on defense, right now, we have surrendered 7 of 28 third downs, which is tied for 19th in the country with Boise State, who we were just talking about, in South Alabama, a couple behind Alabama, actual Alabama, who's in 17th. And that attempt number is pretty in line. Like, it seems around the median of where these like top teams are. So not like we have only attempted, like, faced a few third downs. Like, it's a pretty normal number. So that's a good sign. If that's a thing that we've been a strength, like, year over year strength is I think a good sign that, like, the defense buckles down and can make those big crucial stops.
Yeah. I mean, this is where the Syracuse linebackers, the fact that they're not necessarily, like, especially Ryan Guthrie, not necessarily built for the traditional Tampa 2. This is where their strength more as a you know, pressure focused group can really come in handy, because, you know, you see it a lot. I remember seeing, I think Tyrell Richards pop up a couple times, Ryan Guthrie, Andrew Armstrong, like, those guys were in the backfield last week. Applying some pressure, especially on third down, and being disruptive. Like, I know you and I have said it before. I don't want the Schaefer defense necessarily, but if we can find any way to cause a little bit more havoc, it would really, really be helpful. I think you saw Syracuse wasn't necessarily blitzing at the beginning of the game against Wagner. And it did seem like Wagner was getting a lot of room to run. Suddenly they started blitzing and blitzing relentlessly, and that's when Wagner's offense pretty much came to a grinding halt because it didn't give the quarterback time to spot receivers downfield. It didn't expose our secondary. Like, the secondary's young, and I think there's a high upside to it. Like, Cordy is pretty good. I think that Cisco is a great big play guy, but a guy who might need a little more time cover-wise. Chris Frederick seems to have taken a little bit of a step back, and maybe Scoop too, I'm not sure. As little time as we can get with quarterbacks just sitting in the pocket and finding their man out there, like, they're going to find space, and they're going to find a lot of it, as you saw on that one touchdown drive from Wagner, as you saw for pretty much the whole third quarter for Western Michigan. Like, we need to apply a ton of pressure this year, and that means the defense play looks a lot different than even Dino wanted, but I'm cautiously optimistic that that becomes something. I mean, against a team like Florida State that struggled off in terms of their offensive line, it could mean the difference between a win and a loss is just us just blitzing them relentlessly and seeing what happens.
Yeah, their offensive line really, like, I have way more from the Virginia Tech game, but, like, really, really struggled. And Virginia Tech, going into the year, pretty much the talking point about the defense was this might be the year that Bud Foster's defense takes a huge step back because they were pretty young across the board. And even so, like, they were absolutely relentless in getting after DeAndre Francois, who is like, his numbers are okay, but he doesn't look quite as polished as he even did as a redshirt freshman a couple years ago when he started in that final, that second to last season under Jimbo Fisher. He was hurt in the first game last year. But I've seen some people talking about the possibility that he is just not quite up to the transition from the Fisher offense to the Taggart offense, which is interesting because obviously Jimbo is like the closest to a true pro style guy you're going to get in college, and you would think that would be the more difficult to grasp system, and Taggart's much more of a classic college offense. But it does seem like there's something that hasn't totally clicked where he's making like the appropriate reads and really hasn't latched on to like his guys. But I think the more distressing thing if I'm a Florida State fan is the running game, which is supposed to be a strength of Cam Akers and Jock Patrick, is really not gotten on track at all. Like, they just haven't looked good. Like, they didn't do anything against Virginia Tech. And then even in Sanford, they ran for 134 yards, but it was on 35 carries. And the only score was a Francois punched one in, but not like a super productive run game, even though you have a guy like Akers who's, you know, touted as one of the probably 5 or 10 best backs in the country. And I have to imagine the offensive line is very much responsible for that.
Oh, I absolutely agree. I think the offensive line is the biggest part of it. I think one interesting thing in general, though, on Florida State and on Taggart coming in is that, like, people forget, like, right before the Syracuse-USF game back in the, 2015? I think it was 2015.
Right, 2015. Yeah, 2016 is when they were awesome a whole year.
Yeah, right before that game, USF changed to an up-tempo. But, like, Taggart wasn't necessarily, like, a big spread up-tempo guy.
He's a hardball guy. He's a power running game guy. And basically, like, USF discovered that their most effective offense was when they were going no huddle. So they basically just, like, took the offense they were running and just put it into, like, hyperspeed.
And also had Quentin Flowers and Mack and Biner, right, and all those guys. But, like, I mean, this was, in 2015, they figured it out. Oregon already had the pieces in place to do it when he got there. So it's hard to really take 1 year. I mean, obviously, like, they did well, and Herbert's a great quarterback. But, like, it's very hard to extrapolate that out of it working if you walk into a pro-style type setup the way Florida State is, even with those level of athletes, you know, even with the speed that a lot of teams play with. Like, Florida State doesn't have a specific style that kids play with down there necessarily the way they do in Texas, parts of Oklahoma. Like, you'll find a lot of different systems in Florida, in the state of Florida, and not everybody's ready. I mean, it's the same problem that we face a little bit. And I do wonder, like, if Taggart is just running into a natural growing pain that, like, people just sort of erased from their mind. You know, I even forgot for a few that he wasn't always this known as this coach. And it's amazing how quickly a reputation, I mean, even Babers, to be honest, how quickly a reputation changes. Like, Babers wasn't known as this at all until he got to Baylor. So I think the Florida State's going to be fine, obviously. Might even be fine this year. I just don't know when everything's going to click because right now, yeah, you're seeing those growing pains that you were alluding to with Francois and how that's become kind of contagious for the rest of the team. And it kind of reminds me a little bit of what's happening to a greater extent with like DeVito when he comes in and he's not necessarily, he just isn't at game speed yet. And I think Francois might not be either right now.
Yeah, and Francois is coming off an injury, so that is right. Something to, you know, think about there. But it's interesting because if you had told me going into the year, if you had asked me to pick between like a duo to start with a new offense with, between Herbert and Royce Freeman or Francois and Akers, I don't think talent-wise it's that huge a deficit. Francois was really, really good as a redshirt freshman 2 years ago. Led them to, I believe it was the Orange Bowl against Michigan.
Yep.
Looked like he was going to be, like, he was on Heisman lists all last offseason, and then he got hurt in, like, the second quarter in Alabama, and that was it. And then they, who was the other quarterback whose name is slipping my mind?
James Blackman.
Yes, and Blackman was not as good last year, but kind of grew into the role. He was a true freshman last year, and he was very much not expected to be thrust into that, and then they had a quarterback battle this offseason. Francois was named quarterback, starting quarterback, maybe 2 weeks ahead of the season. So it lasted relatively long. I don't know how decisive it was, but you would think, like, it's interesting that Francois is struggling as much as he is when he had a guy who he had to beat out. It wasn't like Francois just inherited the job. There was a very real question over whether it would be him or Blackman, considering Blackman was, like, one of the few bright spots for Florida State last year and kind of led them through a really crappy situation where everyone seemed checked out, but he was like the true freshman quarterback who was playing, you know, hard and quite well. So the fact that Francois won the job but still looks, you know, not unsure of what exactly he's supposed to be doing in any given situation is a bit of, is interesting.
No, 100%. I think that this is, you know, it's the same deal with like some of Dungy's struggles too, though, is that if Francois doesn't get any part of it, it might also be the offense. Like, well, the offensive line, like if he doesn't have the time to make some quick progressions, or if he just feels like he's under pressure immediately, like all of that's going to be effect. Like I'm seeing a lot of the hallmarks of Syracuse's struggles in recent years in this game. Oh, well, in these last two games, at least for Florida State. I mean, I didn't expect them to struggle with Samford. I don't think anybody really did. Granted, at the same time, like they have a really good quarterback. But 475 yards, like that to me, I don't care who you are. Like it's not, there's a lot of quarterbacks, a lot of really, really good quarterbacks who've never thrown 475 yards against anybody.
Yeah, and it's more jarring is that Samford was up until, what, 7 minutes or so in the fourth quarter, and they had a 5-1 turnover differential. That's like what the Browns did yesterday. Like you were supposed to, you win the game, you win like 95% of those games. The fact that Florida State wasn't like winning going away is shocking, considering Samford gave them the ball 5 times, and Florida State's the one with like top 5, top 10 talent, and Samford's the FCS team. So it's very disconcerting. They just did not take advantage of opportunities at all.
Yeah, that to me is probably the most alarming thing of all. If you can't capitalize on that, like against Samford, then...
Aside from the pitch sits at the end that sealed it, but like that was like the one, like I'm going to go back now and like look at you know, how much they stored off the turnovers, but clearly not as much as they should have.
Yeah, clearly not as much as they should have. And like overall, like, ugh. Like the fact that you needed that pick six to like make this thing look better than it actually was, that it's very, very alarming.
Yeah, they scored 2 touchdowns off of the other turnovers. They scored a touchdown 2 plays after a fumble, and then they scored... Actually, no. The only 2 scores off of turnovers were the touchdown after a fumble in the first half, which was to make it 23-21, and then the pick six, which sealed it, which made it 36-26 after Florida State had taken the lead a little bit earlier. But, yeah, overall, like, not a great ratio considering there are 5 interceptions and you're playing a team, or 5 turnovers in total, and you're playing a team that is definitely at a huge talent disadvantage. So I think I'm, this is all like dumb, but I think I'd rather that Florida State won that game though, because I think an 0-2 Florida State would be a little scarier in terms of like motivation. Like they would really not want to be going 0-3 versus like 1-1. There's a little bit more of a chance that they're resting on their laurels, although that's, you know, kind of pseudoscientific sports talk radio stuff.
Yeah, but you know what? I mean, I think more than anything, it's just like not provable. Like, I think there's something to be said for momentum, even if it's not something that you can always, like, it's not something dependable or reliable or provable. you and I have both been in arenas and watching games when momentum, you see it happen. You can't put a number to it, but you see it. And like, I'm not going to make this into like an existential conversation about like, is momentum real or not, but it's just more in like the hot hand theory and all that. But there's something to be said for, you know, once you're down, there's some groups of people that will like, and this goes for, you know, work, this goes for groups of friends, this goes for anything, not just, you know, football teams, but there's like some groups will just, you know, retreat in on themselves and some won't. And like, it would be hard to say which Florida State team we'd be seeing at 0-2. I think at 1-1, you're not necessarily having that conversation internally yet. You're more just looking at, okay, like got the win, now let's move on. And that might not necessarily mean, you know, move on to Syracuse. It might just mean move on with the rest of our season. Like, when does Florida State face Miami this year?
Early October.
It's 10-6.
It is October 6th. Yep.
All right. So they're not necessarily looking ahead.
No, they're Northern Illinois next week, so it's definitely not a. It's maybe a letdown spot, but it's not a look ahead spot.
Northern Illinois is going to be tough.
They look pretty feisty since Utah.
I mean, their defense is very good.
Yeah, Utah also just might not be very good.
I honestly think it's Northern Illinois' like defense, because I actually think Utah's offense might be okay. Like, it's, I feel like their offense is never like all that lights out, or at least it hasn't been since they joined the Pac-12, but like, I feel like Northern Illinois' defense is just really, really good, and that's I'm going to chalk that up as to why that was such a struggle, which to me gives some very bad vibes for Florida State's in for, no matter what happens against us.
Yeah, that's fair.
I mean, we're getting towards the end here. Let's do an extended predictions series here. Dan, I guess, what do you think is going to happen? Maybe some key touch points in this game. Who's going to matter? Things like that.
I'm still not ready to totally buy in that we're going to beat Florida State. I'm just really concerned about their talent. I think I have enough concerns about our defense that I do think this to be a game where Cam Akers gets going. And our own offensive line issues scare me a bit. Florida State does have talent on the defensive front, although it hasn't really shown itself. So, like, on paper, I think I get why Syracuse is getting looked at like pretty even here, if not like even a slight favorite because of the home field advantage. But I'm going to go with Florida State. I'm going to go with Florida State 34-28.
All right. I really want to pick against Syracuse here, but I feel like I got to go with the Orange. I'm going to be the anti-disloyal idiot for once. I think Syracuse wins this one. I'm going to go 45-41.
Okay, shootout.
Absolute disaster from a defensive standpoint.
What's the over-under? Have they set that yet?
They haven't set that yet. Whatever it is, take the over and run.
I'm looking. So Florida State is currently 2.5 point. They're open at 2.5 point favorites. It's actually moving pretty heavy, Florida State. It's 3.5 to 4 points in the line there. So the money is on Florida State right now. But the over-under is 63. So
what? Mash the over. Jesus Christ, I need to find a sports book.
So my pick was at 62. So I was actually slightly under. But 63 does feel pretty good. If I was to bet, I'd probably actually bet over there.
Yeah, I would bet the over. I'd bet the over until we got to about 80. I know I just said 83 in my, no, not 83, I said 86 in my score. I would not hesitate until we got to 80, and then I'd start thinking a little bit harder about it.
I feel 80 would be scary to me because Florida State scored 3 points against Virginia Tech. Right. And I know that was a little fluky. They should have scored more. And Virginia Tech is probably pretty good in defense, but like, there's a chance their offense is just broken. But there's a chance our defense is just broken, so which one of those gives?
Right. Yeah, I think, yeah, 80 would be my pause. I think I'd be fine with anything up until that.
Yeah, I can't super disagree with you there. I'd probably go under on 80, but I it wouldn't shock me if this game was like 45-40.
Yeah. So yeah, I'm riding with 45-41. I think the Cam Akers runs all over us. I think that we do actually get after DeAndre Francois a little bit. Florida State's real ability to run the ball just comes from us just missing on the blitz, which is something that we were susceptible to when in the Western Michigan game. I think Dungy is able to – I think Dungy gets a little reckless, and that's what, you know, keeps this one really in the balance the entire game. But I think we find a way to run the ball a little bit better than we did against Western Michigan. I think Dungy doesn't have to run for 200 yards. I think we throw the ball reasonably well. I think 45-41, I'm not, like, super confident about that, but I'm choosing to believe. And you know what? I would choose to believe even if I picked a loss. I think that it's not that this team's turning a corner. It's that Florida State's struggling, and it's just whether or not this team is able to take advantage of that.
All right. I hope I am obviously rooting for you to be more right than I am.
I would love to be more right than you are in this case. But yeah, that's really it. I guess we're split here. I know Dan and I usually have the same exact opinions on everything because we've been doing the show for so long. So for once, we are in disagreement.
Yes. Rare, sad moment. Sad divide here on the podcast.
Oh, no. However will we repair this broken friendship? Anyway, Dan, anything else before we depart here?
No, ready for the game. Excited for a big, like, meaningful ACC game. And if we go 3-0, like, it's, I think, unless Florida State's just horrid, like, I think people are pretty justified to really be getting excited here.
People better show up to the UConn game if we're 3-0.
Yes, yeah, that's 100% true. I know they won't. Actually, I don't know. I can never tell.
So many leaves.
Like, they're either going to be like, yeah, the Florida State's absolutely bad, or they're going to still say that UConn's bad. Like, I don't know. People who don't want to show up always find their way. So, just eventually this team will be good enough and people will make the trek out. But I think generally it's the law of Syracuse fandom is, like, if there is a reason for them to not show up, they will not show up.
Well, you saw the numbers from this weekend, right? Where, like, it was one of the worst attended home openers in, like, a long time. Despite the fact that we moved it a week, and it was a sure win, and
yeah, but people don't like the sure wins. People want us to go and beat Clemson every week,
which is
that's the only,
like,
time. Yeah,
like, do you people not have any joy in life? Like if that's your standard, like, there's no way you enjoy any aspect of your life.
It's really infuriating, and I try not to get worked up about attendance because, like, it's just there's so many more important things to get annoyed about. That are talked about every week, but, like, people want to, like, know they're going to show for a win, but also want that win to be against a name opponent, and it just, like, you're not going to ever always get that. You have to go to the games, and some are going to be good and some are going to be bad, and you hope that the, like, overall it's a positive year of experiences for you, and support your team and it looks better, and you knowing helps a small amount towards, like, looking better to recruits and whatnot. Like, I try not to blame people so much for not showing up, but if you don't show up, like, don't make some lame-ass excuse about, like, the opponent was bad.
That's because, my, like, thing. I don't care about the number anymore. What I care about is excuses that get tossed out there of why they're not going. And
also, you should be showing up for your team. Like, right. I get, like, more people are going to be interested in showing up for Clemson game. Like, if I was able to get up every week, I'd tailor my schedule more to the big games. But, like, at the end of the day, like, you're showing up to watch Syracuse play.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that there's... Again, there's, like, this weird standard. I think part of it comes from the basketball team and its long history of success. But, like, hey, you guys should be able to separate those two things from one another. Like, if you've been a basketball fan for decades, even if you've been a basketball fan for a decade, you understand the difference between football and basketball. Like, you need to apply the same exact standards to one another. I think there's this weird, again, it's this weird dynamic where, like, if you apply the standard for, you know, how you root for a sports team to any other aspect of your life, you wouldn't do it. But, like, there's this need for this very vocal group of Syracuse fans in particular, and I'm sure other schools have this too, of, like, this have your cake and eat it too type approach where, like you said, the opponent needs to be good. Syracuse needs to be good. You need to guarantee a win. Like, there's all this, there's all these boxes you need to check in order to show up. And, like, there's only a handful of football teams in the country that can get all that.
Right.
So, like, you'd be miserable no matter who you were rooting for, save, like, Alabama.
Yeah, and even Alabama fans leave if it's, like, a blowout. Like, yeah. it's definitely like more than just a Syracuse problem. It's a college football problem, which is well documented. But the Syracuse like brand of it is very, very infuriating.
Oh yeah, I mean, this is even like, you know, getting rid of the like leaves to rake and apples to pick.
Yes.
Nonsense. Which again, if Syracuse would just take my advice, just have a leaf raking contest in the quad and
oh, you're so good.
Plant apple trees in the concourse.
That'd be such a perfect troll.
They never do it though.
No, because like, they're too afraid of offending their fans that don't show up anyway.
If we ran SU Athletics, that'd be the first thing I would do. Like after fixing the uniforms, then that would be okay. So be the second thing I'd do is I would pull the ultimate troll move and plant apple trees in the concourse of the dome.
You're so good.
Anyway, that was Dan. I'm John. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in to Troy Noon's An Absolute Podcast. You can rate, review, subscribe on iTunes, on Blog Talk. And happy birthday this week, Dan. Enjoy it, and go Orange.
Go Orange, and thank you.